He's one of those breed of people that we love here. He's the coding lawyer, the geek legal beagle mix, which is fantastic. He's come to the Berkman Center after getting his law degree at Harvard Law School, and I turn it over to you, Chris. Thanks.
All right. I'll correct one thing that Rob said already. If your laptops are connected to the Harvard network, don't worry. We already scanned the hard drive. You don't have to submit it to anything. So as Rob said, I've been a fellow with the OpenEd Initiative and the Surveillance Project for most of the last year. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the aims of the project than about the results of the project, just because there have been a few events recently that have pushed to the forefront yet again the idea that, you know, whether or not surveillance is a proper topic for discussion, whether government should acknowledge, whether companies should acknowledge what they're doing, what the role is of exposing surveillance practices in terms of furthering both, you know, separate goals, you know, human rights, civil liberties, privacy, but also in just accomplishing the goals of the surveillance itself. Ethan nicely stole much of my thunder with an article, or was cited heavily in a Newsweek article a week or two ago about repression 2.0, which is okay, because that gets to be my final thought, and we can talk about that afterwards. The idea being that, you know...
Purely by accident, I told him that I knew nothing about it,
and
tried to drive it.
Right. But the idea of this was a Newsweek article about 2 weeks ago came out, which basically stated that one of the most effective ways to use surveillance to suppress speech is simply to announce that you're doing it. The threat of surveillance, the idea of exposure, has a real effect. It's basically an observer effect, which is to say, if you think you're being monitored, not know, but just think, you will behave differently, which is in direct contrast to what a lot of the U.S. government says right now, which is to say, we will not admit anything about our surveillance program. It needs to all be secret because that is the only way we can keep it effective. So what I want to talk about is some of the rationales behind this argument, how you determine what can and cannot be talked about in the surveillance world, how I think you should, how I think the government's wrong, things like that. Anyhow, I'll skip over the introduction. As I said, I'm a fellow with the OpenEd Initiative, which is a research project dedicated to understanding and disseminating information about the practice of internet censorship and surveillance. Rob is the director of this project. This is a documentation project. So the idea is not to advocate for or against censorship. We all have strong feelings about that, I'm sure. But the idea is more to simply document the practice, expose ways in which censorship is unannounced more than anything. You know, if you have filtering going on, but all you see is an error page, this is relevant. And the Surveillance Project was basically a branch off of that. It's a cousin of sorts. The idea is to achieve the same goal, which is to increase the understanding of online surveillance. Internet, digital, I'm going to use these terms interchangeably, but it's essentially computer data-related surveillance. And the audience is everyone from academics to governments and activists, both to general public, just informing people as to what the practice is. And the easiest approach to this is, of course, to study what's actually happening. You know, look for evidence of surveillance, when people identify they're being monitored, when leaks come out, when there's public announcements by governments or other entities as to their practices of surveillance. Unfortunately, as I just said, this is fairly limited, part because, you know, for various reasons, people aren't eager to talk about surveillance practices, and so they don't. So the project is basically branching into other ways to measure what's going on in the surveillance world, looking at capabilities, so looking at the tools that are out there, ranging from devices that actually can be injected over a network and read your hard drive. I did not do that, but there are people at least investigating that capability for surveillance purposes, from reading, you know, intercepting email at an ISP level to simply storing email on Gmail and accessing it that way. And then things like Facebook and Google Docs and other online sources of data that may be available to someone who wants to build a profile of an individual or just collect information for potential future use sometimes. We also look at the infrastructure. I also lean away from the mic. As close as possible. So also looking at the infrastructure. So how is, you know, the internet or any given network laid out? What does that mean about the capability to conduct surveillance? Looking at legal, political constraints. So in some countries, the legal constraints are very strong. There's the rule of law. We can at least assume that, you know, constraints established by the Constitution, by legislation, by other authorities are followed. In other countries, the constraints are more political. What can the government get away with? How are they pushing limits? Or how do we think they're pushing limits? And then we can also look, and this is getting beyond what we have done into what we might do, into the effectiveness of surveillance. So you know, not just how well does it capture information, that's known, but how well is this information actually being used? You know, the idea that we have comprehensive terrorist surveillance in this country through the NSA's program, which we'll talk lots more about, is that actually leading into effective prevention of terrorist attacks? Is it actually accomplishing the goals it's looking for? And I want to talk a little bit more about the reason that keeping everything secret is hinders this. And then, of course, you know, a lot of the information about surveillance is looking at the implications. So, you know, there are privacy, civil liberties, human rights issues that, you know, a lot of people in this room are more familiar with than I am. There are the effects on third parties, where people have to comply with legal requirements to enable surveillance, things like CALEA, which is the U.S. law that requires an ISP or a communications carrier to enable wiretapping. Obviously, subpoenas and court orders that require turnover of information, data retention laws that require people to hold information. So there's a whole range of effects on third parties that affect how they operate completely outside of the role of surveillance. There's a broader effect on just the rule of law. When you have, and this is tying into the secrecy aspect, which is that if you have separate entities conducting unknown affairs that are interpreting what their own legality, it is not an automatic turn into a despotic state, but it certainly is a threat to the idea that everyone is accountable, that there are a series of checks and balances over different aspects of governance. And then there are social effects. People's, you know, behavior changes when they think they're being surveilled, when they know they're being surveilled. When there's a camera in front of you, you know, if you're walking down the street in London, you may behave differently. This is not a positive or negative per se. It just is something that needs to be aware of. So as I said, there are a couple of things that got me thinking about this. One was maybe 2 months ago, there was a New Yorker article about the NSA's Mike McDonnell, who's the director of the NSA, and there was a quote, which was, "We have a saying in this business, privacy and security are a zero-sum game. The idea basically being that anything that is protective of privacy, whether it's, you know, any kind of check and balance, any kind of oversight, any kind of, you know, limitation on what people can do with information, is de facto a threat to security because it limits, you know, legitimate law enforcement and intelligence efforts to prevent serious harms." This is not obviously everyone's perspective in or out of government, but it certainly is an idea that transparency and surveillance are opposite forces, that the more you disclose about a surveillance program, the less effective it is. But that's not necessarily true. The strongest argument is that there are positives even towards surveillance goals that come from disclosure. One of them is, you know, in some cases, it's effective. If you want people to participate in something, you want to advertise this. You know, if you are Google Mail or you're Google and you want people to know our search is great because we reference what people do, you may want to disclose this fact. If you are trying to discourage a particular activity, like most criminal investigative surveillance, you know, the goal is not to capture criminals, the goal is to prevent crime. And if that's how you frame your goal, disclosing the fact of surveillance is an effective tool. Now, there's a balance, of course, between how much you disclose and how much you don't disclose, which I'll get to. And then, of course, you're supporting other things, which I will talk about. But what happens when you talk about surveillance depends greatly on what you're trying to do with surveillance, first of all. If you are doing something in a commercial setting, whether it's Beacon, where you're trying to provide a service basically through surveillance, you're watching what your or Facebook watches what your friends do and tells you. This is, to some extent, a form of online surveillance. It's not one that has a lot of transparency issues simply because, well, it's de facto transparent, but it's also something that Facebook expects people to agree with. Other situations, Ask.com has introduced a opt-out system of enabling, you know, them to record your search results. This is it's a commercial transaction of sorts, and they're very public about, we will record your search results unless you opt out. Form is a form of targeted advertising, which has gotten a lot of press in the UK. There have been reports that US ISPs are considering it. It basically monitors, in broad sense, your surfing activity. So if I go to a website like ESPN.com, it will record that I visited a website that has to do with sports. And then perhaps another website will say, I want to serve an ad to this person. What kind of ad should I serve? Oh, well, they like sports. I'll serve this. So this is offering a commercial service. It's not necessarily something that benefits me directly, but it certainly is something that I, you know, I'm commercially affected by. When you get to actual law enforcement or intelligence surveillance, you have a very different purpose. Your purpose is not to encourage something. Your purpose is not to enable something. Your purpose is generally to prevent something. You are preventing harmful activities. You are preventing, you know, terrorism. You're preventing botnets from taking over the internet, anything like this. So you have an actor who is basically fighting against this surveillance. And that certainly affects how transparent you want to be, or how transparency, you know, affects the success of the surveillance program. The other thing, of course, is the audience. Who knows about this? You know, the default option seems to be nobody knows. But that's not necessarily the best way to handle it. Now, you have two parties that are the most interesting, which are surveillance targets themselves. If someone wants to avoid surveillance, either just because, you know, not just because, either out of privacy concerns or because they want to actually hide illicit activity, they're someone who will be very interested in and try to exploit any information that they're provided. If you have affected third parties, one example being in a botnet situation where the people you're monitoring are not necessarily the people creating these networks. They're the people who are infected. But you certainly have a third party who is going to try to use whatever information is available to circumvent surveillance. And then you have other interested parties, which at one point said the legislature, and really should say the legislature, because you have people who are involved in oversight, who are not necessarily the general public, but who have a role to play in monitoring, in protecting against abuse of information gleaned through surveillance. And, you know, disclosing information to a limited audience is very different than disclosing information to the public at large or to some of the parties who have a tendency to, or have the potential to hinder the effectiveness by knowing this. It also matters greatly what you're talking about. So the idea of hiding all information about surveillance is very different than hiding the specifics. So if you're talking about the purpose of surveillance, disclosing that a surveillance program is designed to counteract, you know, identity theft, you know, talking about the scope. This is monitoring specific individuals. This is monitoring broad networks of individuals. This is monitoring a specific set of data sources. This is looking at communication. This is not looking at communications. Things like this are one element you could disclose. How it's implemented gets a little bit fuzzier, because if you're worried about counter-surveillance, then the more implementation details you give, the more circumvention may happen. Now, on the other hand, if your goal is to discourage the activity in the first place, if you provide details that show that you have a comprehensive system of surveillance, this may, in fact, encourage people to avoid the activity in the first place. And again, you know, part of the question of disclosure is whether it comports with or disagrees with existing expectations. So when you have a society that expects surveillance, disclosure is, you know, has limited effect on whether or not your surveillance activities will be successful. If you have society which does not expect surveillance, then the effect is greater. Whether it's positive or negative depends on other factors. So basically, just a couple of examples of how disclosure is not just a one-way street. So if you're talking about monitoring file sharing, I'm sure someone in this room has illegally downloaded a file at some point in their life. And you know, the general perception in the US right now is probably something like this. We're able sometimes, under some circumstances, to detect illegal file sharing, and we'll we will sue people we catch. You know, this is vague. This is a statement of a purpose and a general goal, but it's not particularly effective in changing behavior in any sense. If you change to we're able to detect a specific amount, if you increase the success rate and you announce this, this may actually be a discouragement. Unless, of course, you're telling people how you're doing it. If we're able to detect everyone who's doing illegal file sharing via BitTorrent, you just don't use BitTorrent. So the question is not whether you're telling people about surveillance. The question is what you're telling people about surveillance. And then, of course, there are other ways of giving more information that may target specific activities. If you're concerned about illegal file sharing, and this is, again, I'm going to get back myself into defending the RIAA here, which is not what I mean to do. But one of the approaches you can take to this is to target a specific activity like downloading, rather than we're going after people uploading. So now we're not targeting people who download files. We're targeting people who upload files, because if we can shut off the upload source, we've solved our problem. So you get into, when you're dealing with other actors, botnets are a good example. Again, the surveillance is not targeted at the people you're really behavior you're trying to affect. If you're conducting surveillance to try to watch for botnets, to shut off attacks by botnets, to even just to measure infection vectors of botnets, which is fairly similar to what's happening with diseases right now. This is something that there are people who are interested in this information who will use it, you know, against the purposes of the surveillance program. On the other hand, you know, if you're able to inform people, you know, in a herdict or other type situation, you know, we are monitoring your behavior and we can identify that, you know, you have done something, we don't know what even, but you've done something that has caused your computer to be infected. Maybe you're aiding at user education, you're helping, you know, you're accomplishing the goal of reducing botnets in the overall situation. And of course, you can't talk surveillance without terrorism right now. And one of the questions, which is broadest here, is, you know, is announcing a surveillance program actually a deterrent at all? You know, when you're talking about criminal activity, file sharing, people are not invested in this heavily. If you scare them enough, they will go away. One of the arguments, you have a question yet? Or?
No.
Okay.
No, I just have a question about the, is there data on the people's response to the RIA?
Is there data on the people's response to the RIA?
My impression was that people weren't, in fact, scared off.
No, they weren't, partly because it's not a, so there's no substantial, there's no measurement as to how many people. No one has an appreciation, as far as I can tell, of what the risk is. There are instances, there are news stories, but there's no one saying, you know, I'm actually likely to be targeted. To the extent that there is, I'm likely to be targeted if I do this. So I get the impression there's a general, but no, I don't have data, I guess is the short answer.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem. So terrorism, again, is the same question, which is, you know, what are the effects of discussing, of disclosing information about a program? Are you actually enabling, you know, counter-surveillance? Are you furthering your goal, furthering the goals of the project, which is to prevent terrorism, or are you simply collecting data in, as an end to itself? So I want to go through what the goals of transparency, which boil down to the goals of the surveillance project, are. Which is not, I mean, our goals are not to enable surveillance necessarily. Our goals are to protect other interests. Human rights, civil liberties, obviously, are one of the primary factors. So we're looking at, you know, freedom of expression, privacy rights, things like this that are impacted by surveillance, but that are even more impacted by surveillance that is, you know, unconstrained by any kind of oversight. So the goal, of course, of the project is not to say surveillance is bad. The goal is to say surveillance is something that needs to be understood, that needs to be publicly discussed, that needs to be monitored. So again, enhancing the rule of law. When you have surveillance that is overseen, you are enabling other entities, so legislatures, the public in some cases, to, you know, evaluate what the role of this is. Now, you know, obviously getting into details may detract from the effectiveness, but what you can talk about enables people to, you know, intelligently discuss the pros and cons, the benefits and the drawbacks, and this, you know, and more to the point, to discuss what the law actually says. If you have legal constraints on surveillance, and the only people evaluating these constraints or considering whether to comply with these constraints are in a cloud of secrecy, you know, they're of little impact. And then another, the final thing is just to objectively review. So as I talked about, the terrorism is a prominent explanation for surveillance right now. Looking through terrorism cases in the U.S., the majority of cases based on surveillance are not cases where hardened terrorism networks have been identified. Their cases, more often than not, I do have some data on this, but not in presentable form, that are simply people who have an interest in Islam, who are possible radicals, who become basically, who are curious and eventually are pulled in. Sometimes it comes close to entrapment, sometimes it is legitimate interest, but these are people who might be deterred. If your assumption at the beginning is that there is no possibility of deterrence, then you discount the possibility of talking about the program and attempting deterrence. And if you start with the presumption that surveillance capturing real terrorists is impossible, if you give any information about the program, you're discounting part of the effectiveness of the overall goal, which is not catching terrorists, it's preventing terrorism. The other thing, of course, is that there are a lot of procedural things within a surveillance organization that also could benefit from exposure. Things like procedures that, you know, authorize particular investigations, that protect data after it's obtained. There are a wide range of privacy goals and other goals that, you know, can be overseen completely separate from the actual practice of surveillance itself. So whether there's auditing of access to this information, what data sources are used, what how data is verified. These are procedural aspects that legitimately should be evaluated by someone outside of the person, outside of the entity invested in collecting information. So again, the goal, you know, my argument, again, this is whether this is an argument that government should do this or an argument that, you know, I'm trying not to argue that someone should do my job for me. My job is to investigate surveillance, and there are meaningful ways to do this. But there are also a number of ways that people who are conducting surveillance, you know, just simply shortcut the process of evaluating what the role of disclosure is. And there are a lot of situations where there are limited negative effects and substantial benefits to disclosure. When you're talking about things like just the mere existence of a surveillance program, you know, if your idea is to deter negative activity, existence is unlikely to be a substantial barrier to, you know, existence of a surveillance program is generally not going to deter people or is not going to encourage people to take steps to prevent detection. If they're concerned about that, they're already taking them. If they're not concerned about that, then the existence, you know, is futile. I'm sorry. So the purpose of the program, part of the reason for this is that surveillance should be narrowly defined. If you get into a situation where the purpose of a program is to collect information, there's no defining limit. You know, the goal is total information awareness, you know, which was the most horrible title of a program ever designed, I think. But you know, if you talk about the purpose of a program as, and you define it as a concrete outcome, then you allow discussion of this outcome. And you're not necessarily, you know, contradicting the purpose by disclosing what the purpose of the program is. Scope of the program, you're getting a little fuzzier. There are situations where announcing DriftNet operations may change people's behavior, for better or for worse, but it certainly has greater effects. You talk about the sources of data. You know, are you taking public data? Are you taking private data? Are you intercepting? Are you capturing? These are potential disclosures. These are not something that necessarily every government is going to disclose in every instance. But they are, you know, topics for discussion that should be discussed as not, you know, not simply rolled into a conclusion. And the third-party cooperation, in particular, third-party cooperation that is nominally voluntary. There are a number of places where, you know, in some cases, third-party cooperation is mandatory. It's legislated. There's less of an argument to be made there. But where it's voluntary, where there is a contract between an agent between two third parties or between a government and a third party involving the transfer of data, there's less of an argument to prevent disclosure. And there's more of an argument, well, the benefits aren't greater, but the argument for prevention is less. Because if there's a need to for secrecy, there's a need for oversight. And again, talking about the internal procedures with collected data, which does not necessarily touch on what the data is whatsoever, simply on what is done with it and how it's protected. And then the legal interpretation as well. Let's get through a little bit. So again, talking about digital surveillance, I've kind of babbled on a little bit too much about what surveillance in general is. What's different about digital surveillance and how does it impact this? So one of the differences, you have vastly increased surveillance potential. So you're looking at potential to capture information about large populations rather than target individuals. You have the potential to aggregate information from a variety of sources. You can collect public, private, you know, semi-private, intercepted, you know, subpoenaed. There are multiple sources of information that can be aggregated into, you know, an awareness. And as the scope increases, again, the reason for suppressing information seems to decline. I forgot, I sold a Jay-Z side. I forgot what I was going to do with it. But so, for example, one of the new sources of information is things like OnStar. OnStar is, of course, the service in your car that will help you get where you're going, and you can call for help if you get lost. It's also capable of capture by law enforcement authorities who have subpoenaed OnStar. They lost this particular case, but it's a technology that could be enabled to capture voice conversation in the car by remotely activating a microphone and funneling all communication, all audible signals into, you know, a law enforcement collection agency. This actually happened for a couple of years before the program was shut down. It was shut down on very narrow grounds. The argument was not that this is an illegitimate use of legal authority. The argument was that by enabling capture of OnStar data, the police were actually shutting down the purpose of the call button, which was to call for help. Because if you tried to call for help while the police were listening in, you wouldn't get anything. Or you get the FBI operator, who might not be able to get you out of the ditch. So another thing to remember about digital surveillance is that the legal constraints are often very unclear. There are, case law in the U.S. has not really addressed the issue of whether there's Fourth Amendment protection for URLs, whether there's protection for data stored on a remote server somewhere, exactly what the requirements are. And in cases where there are clearly no protection, information on Facebook, information obtained through private data repositories, there's not a, existing law has not necessarily kept up with the ability of surveillance agents to collect information. And again, it's not just collect information, it's what information can be stored, what information can be used for, and how information can be shared. So we're ranging from targeted investigations that are narrow in purpose and narrow in time span to a broader investigation that essentially can be archived and referenced at any future point. This is not, the ease of reference, the ease of sharing this with another entity who's curious within the government, without the government, between third parties, is very different in the digital age. And this certainly impacts what surveillance means. Again, the surveillance mechanisms are changing rapidly, and the communication methods are changing rapidly. Surveillance has gone from capturing phone calls to, asking Yahoo for information about dissidents in China. There's no longer the need to capture something in real time. There's now archived information about almost everything you do in the digital world that can reconstruct much of what much of your activity without having to have a live capture. And again, there's increasing role of private entities. Companies like Yahoo, Google, Facebook, ChoicePoint, OnStar are all involved in surveillance efforts at different degrees. They're collecting information. They are adjusting their systems to comply with this. And they very much, obviously this is not new. Phone companies have been involved in wiretapping. But the number of entities that have some role in collecting information, in dealing in information, and therefore are potential sources for information from the surveillance world is very different. I guess that was my parting thoughts. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that the idea that surveillance is necessarily secret and that accomplishing the goals of surveillance requires secrecy seems to be very widespread in a number of agencies in the surveillance world. And I hope that the goal of the project is to somewhat argue that this is not the right way to approach things, that surveillance needs public discussion, that surveillance needs oversight, that surveillance needs an awareness of what the goals of surveillance are, how to narrowly accomplish those goals while protecting other interests. And again, as I said, I'll come back to Ethan's Zimbabwe story, which is that disclosure, just simply information, is not necessarily a positive thing either. Informing the public in Zimbabwe that the Interception and Communication Act allows the government, without court authority, ministerial authority, to basically capture any communications, if there is a perceived threat to national security or a broad number of other constraints, which boils down to when we feel like it, is an effective tool in and of itself to harm some of the interests that I think we hold, we hold important. Even if there is no practice of surveillance, which the best of, there is no evidence of surveillance, to be sure. It's obvious, it's very hard to say there is no practice. But so part of the, where disclosure breaks down is that, and where research becomes useful, is not so much in measuring what is happening, but what is not happening. Because it's actually probably easier to exaggerate surveillance capabilities than it is to, understate them. Or it's at least as easy. And the consequences are different. And, if we can contribute something, it may be more in limiting the effects of overstatement of surveillance than in limiting the effects of understatement, because we need help from people who are involved in understanding that a dialogue about surveillance is meaningful. That's all I have. Oh, I have one more slide. That's not good.
Two slides ago, you talked about the the number of private companies that are changing their practices to comply with or ongoing surveillance efforts or something like that. So I just wondered if you'd say a little more on that.
Well, so there are two things. First of all, there are requirements that companies, there are legal requirements in many cases that companies behave.
Financial services companies
have data retention and privacy retention as well.
Right.
Telecommunications operators are required to enable wiretapping, and this has been extended to voice over IP operators in the last decade. There are pending data retention laws. There's a past data retention initiative, although it's not fully in effect in Europe, which requires information service providers to retain information about, different aspects of customer behavior so that law enforcement can access this, some time period after the fact. So it's not necessarily a business interest, it is a requirement. But in other cases, this aligns with business interests. If you are, for example, if you are already storing information, you have an interest in storing information, if you are trying to model profile your users in order to give them better service, you are then creating another avenue for potential surveillance from whoever wants to access this information, whether you're selling it, whether you're complying with a court order to hand it over, whether you're just voluntarily giving it away and opening up your network and people are using it in unexpected ways.
And that's sort of what you're thinking about when you're talking about Google and whatnot.
Yeah, so
they're collecting more and more, and now it becomes subpoenable or otherwise.
Yeah, and Google has
the initiative came from them to hold it in the first place.
Yes,
right?
And the challenge is, Google has been subpoenaed for search records, and they fought that, but they did not fight that on the grounds that the request was illegitimate, that it was a violation of privacy rights or anything. They fought it on the grounds that it was simply overbroad, and they could not hand over the DOJ's request for search records. This was a attempt to understand the attempts to obtain child pornography, and Google simply said this was not an argument that this is an invasion of privacy even if we anonymize the data. It was I don't know what the request was specifically, whether it had any identifying or reverse engineered identifiable characteristics. That's also one of the talking about private entities, and this applies pretty broadly, is that where companies are aggregating data, often they are trying, in some extent, to protect privacy. But the mechanism is not always peer-reviewed, is not always publicized, and often is flawed. There have been a couple of cases of supposedly anonymous data released for various reasons. One was AOL's data set, one was with Netflix. And fairly quickly, people who were interested took the information and de-anonymized it, at least to some degree, so they could identify particular users on Netflix with users on IMDb, and then extract from that what these IMDb users were also ordering from Netflix, which was not publicly reviewed because they might not have wanted to, expose their political affiliation, sexual orientation, anything of the sort.
So I guess to put a sharp point on my question, in the U.S., mm-hmm. are there any laws beyond wiretapping and child pornography laws that are forcing and these financial retention of financial record financial transactions laws that have caused private companies to alter their data retention practices in the way that feeds into those private laws motivated by surveillance laws motivated by surveillance motives.
There are no data retention laws in the U.S. There's no requirement to, except in financial and a few specific sectors, to retain information, particularly from information services. I'm not familiar with anything else that would point towards a requirement. Besides the obvious requirement to comply with specific requests.
So far, so good.
I'm a huge fan of this research and worried about just how hard it is to do. And I sort of wanted to add another piece to this, which is the gap between what may actually be possible in surveillance and the gap that people perceive to be possible in surveillance, I suspect, is pretty vast. A pretty common situation for me is to go meet with human rights activists in the Middle East. And something that usually happens kind of after the main conversation, usually while we're having a beer or a cup of tea or something afterwards, is someone will say, well, of course, you know the entire internet passes through 7 computers in Washington, D.C. that monitor everything we say. So please don't email me about this. And you find yourself trying to explain this rumor, which has attained the status of fact in large chunks of the world. It would not be hard to find an Egyptian who is reasonably well-educated who believes that the U.S. is capable of monitoring every single communication on the internet. And you can sit there and start graphing out just how much the magnitude of data would be, how different that is from the actual net architecture. Doesn't work. What it actually does is suggest that you know a lot about this, which means that you're probably CIA, and then actually like, yeah. Your interaction at that point starts breaking down. But I think one of the things that's so tricky about this, I appreciate your argument about transparency. I'd love to see more transparency on this. But I think the forces against transparency are so much stronger than the forces for transparency. The truth is, we change our action to comply with projects that we know nothing about. An example of this, a good friend of mine, Shahid Amanullah, runs an amazing website called altmuslim.com. And it's basically a site for very observant but sort of politically alternative Muslims around the world, particularly in the U.S. Shahid has been approaching DHS, Department of State, anyone who can get to listen to him, because he's got this great idea. He's an extremely talented Quranic scholar, and what he wants to do is go into online message boards and argue Quran with people who are attempting to get people to become suicide bombers. You would think this is the sort of thing you would want to encourage brave, patriotic Americans to get engaged with. He won't do it. And the reason he won't do it is that he firmly, and I would argue correctly, believes that if he does it, he will be on a no-fly list for the rest of his life. And I've had this conversation with people in a number of different three-letter agencies who, after bouncing it around a number of times, have come back and said, yeah, tell him not to do that. He's going to end up on a no-fly list for the rest of his life. We know very little about what the surveillance systems are. In these three-letter conversations I've had, no one has ever said to me, oh, yes, we're following IPs and we're matching them to these specific message boards. But even that vague sense is enough to radically reshape his behavior. So, I guess what I would say on all of this is do not neglect the panopticon. It is so much more powerful than what we can do technically. And the panopticon effect, I would argue, is orders of magnitude more powerful than what these systems are actually capable of doing. And I think if you do manage to add real transparency to them by essentially saying, here is state of the art, here is what we know is commercially available, you're going to get ignored and dismissed because there's this assumption that the military tech and the intelligence tech on this is so many orders of magnitude better than that, and they'd never let us see it anyway, that it's not going to carve away at that psychological effect. We may know that the truth is there probably isn't an order of magnitude difference. It's probably within an order of magnitude what NSA can do versus what the best commercially available stuff can do. But getting that as a public perception, I would argue, is going to be nigh impossible. I just think all of Hollywood over the last 40 years, 24, you know, any number of other extremely powerful media properties are stacked against you making that particular argument.
I guess, it's a pretty fundamental question. Are surveillance programs trying to change behavior, or are they trying to gather information? And if they're trying to change behavior, then the perception, and then the question is, this project is huge, and so is the focus on surveillance is trying to change behavior, or on surveillance is trying to gather information? And they get so often sort of lumped together, but separating them out seems to make it a little easier to say, disclosure helps change behavior, maybe less disclosure helps actually gather information.
No, that's certainly true. I think I should clarify that this was a lunch talk and not my summary of the program as a whole. And the program as a whole is looking at both of those. But to the extent that there is a difference, it's disturbing to me that the goal of a project is to gather information to store away for a rainy day. That has, you know, in a democratic society, that's just creating a resource that's, you know, it's not just potential for abuse, it's almost inevitable mission creep. That if you have this great resource, people are going to start to want to tap into it. And so part of the idea of disclosure, which is not necessarily to the public at large, but to somebody objective, independent of the agency with oversight capabilities, is to keep a focus on what is the purpose. The purpose of intelligence gathering is not just intelligence gathering. It should be accomplishing something. And to the extent that you can understand that you can talk about the purpose and you can discuss the purpose with someone outside the agency, you can help to keep that focus instead of turning it into, you know, we'll gather the data now and figure out what to do with it later. Because that's, you know, it leads to an enormously dangerous repository of information, potentially useful too. But if you don't have a goal for it, then you collect everything. You have all the abstraction of information. You have all the links, and you just kind of keep it around for whatever you think it might be useful for in the future. You'll find a use for it. And that use might not be as wise, as public policy oriented, as defining the use first and fitting the project around the purpose afterwards. But no, I think there certainly, that is an issue. And that's one of the things that, you know, is worth documenting, is to the extent to which, you know, intelligence is gathered as an end in itself and not as a means to an end. You know, and commercially, that's less true because, you know, if there's not a commercial output, it's, you know, there aren't too many places that just gather all the information they can get their hands on. They have targets, they have, you know, they have customers, and they will gather everything that their customers will pay for, but they will not gather everything they can do and then try to find a customer base afterwards. Within an independent entity where you have a mandate to accomplish a fairly broad set of goals, it's a lot easier to imagine the case of collecting first, asking questions about it later, asking questions how to protect it later. How well do you counter surveillance?
Yeah, so if I
the applications
emails work? Or if I can, you know, use some proxy to access the website.
I mean, that's pretty unclear. There, if you are a specific target of surveillance, if you're identified as a target in a technologically sophisticated country, there is very little you can do online that can't be captured. Because if someone has access to your computer, there are, you know, it can be password protected. If you have, I mean, possibly if you have full disk encryption, randomized memory with application locations, things like this, you can deter, but the most sophisticated people can counter almost anything, which is why Ethan's shaking his head.
Roger and I had the fun experience of consulting to a human rights group in an unnamed Asian nation. And this is not what one would think of as a highly technically advanced nation. And we went through Roger's tools and some of the other tools that we're familiar with and talked about sort of securing infrastructure. And ultimately, it turned out that a lot of people were being turned over because they were using Skype, which after some debate, we both agreed was a hell of a lot better than using an unencrypted phone line. And the way that known activists were getting arrested was parabolic microphones and houses two or three doors down the street. In a sufficiently repressive nation with a sufficiently well-endowed law enforcement system, if you are a known activist, you are, in technical terms, fucked. And you know, it may have nothing to do with these networks. That space between user and machine is an incredibly vulnerable space.
Now, if you're an unknown activist, it's a little different. And that, it depends on a lot of things. You know, one way to try to protect yourself is to use encryption, you know, or Tor, or a lot of other things. The problem is that you can be identified as a Tor user, or, you know, at least the traffic coming out of Tor node can be identified. You know, you can be identified as using encryption of different sorts. You're using PGP, it's signed, you have evidence of this. And in some cases, that is enough to take you from an unknown random entity to someone, you know, to watch, you know, with more effort. as far as I can tell, and this is not at all a recommendation for an activist, but the strongest way to keep yourself anonymous and still communicate about this is obfuscation. Talk about it, you know, while you're on World of Warcraft with your buddies. That's, you know, the more noise there is, the less likely you are to be swept up by something that is trying to comprehensive surveil. But it's certainly not, it's no guarantee. It's just, it's reducing your chances of being identified as doing something unusual, but it's not preventing someone who actually is dedicated to finding you from having at least a chance of finding you.
So. Does anybody use steganography?
What's that?
Does anybody use steganography?
I mean, I'm sure they do. I haven't heard of a lot of internet uses of it, simply because it has the same, you know, basically you have to have, I mean, if you have separate keys, you can transmit the keys separately. Steganography is a good way to hide your messages in an image or whatever. But I haven't found a lot of tools that actually enable this. It's actually a good question for Roger, probably better than me.
There is a widespread myth that you can hide messages in the low order bits of pictures and nobody will ever tell that you did it. Unfortunately, this is false. There are easy statistical tests to look at a picture and say, wow, the low order bits on that picture are really, really random. They're not the distribution that you would find coming out of a camera. And every time I talk to dissidents and advocates and privacy nuts, they say, oh, well, yeah, of course I could do this picture steganography thing. And then I have to step back and try to explain that that's not how math works.
Even if you encrypt it first?
Yeah, either way. Especially if you encrypt it first, might be the better answer.
There's a nice little paper that came out of the University of Michigan in 2001, which was the first detection of a stego image in the wild. So stego is the sort of thing that CS geeks just love to obsess about. There are more books written, you know, sort of hinging on, you know, steganography being used all over the place. For a little while when I was running customer service for Tripod, I sort of assumed that after a while we got so efficient at taking down porn images that were being put up that I assumed that the only reason they were being put up for 15 minutes at a time was to send steganographically encrypted messages. But there's good programs out there that do the math that Roger's talking about, one of them called StegBreak, which basically looks for the common methods you'd use to do this.
So you have to use something a little more clever, that's all.
So, well, I mean, so that's an interesting question. But what's most interesting, I think, is knowing the 20 or 30 tools that are out there that'll do good stego, knowing that things like StegBreak are pretty much up to date with them. By 2001, a pretty determined effort at UMich had only found one instance of this actually occurring. So I think it's, you know, it's kind of like object-oriented programming. Everybody talks about it, but no one really does it.
No one's been caught doing it.
Right. Maybe actually more effective than you think.
This is another example of the privacy nut saying, no, steganography will work fine.
I'm not a privacy nut. I'm just curious about
my math isn't good enough to make the argument.
But it wouldn't help with me anyway.
My understanding of this is that most of the common data hiding techniques produce a mathematically very different file from a conventional image file. And that there are some sort of first passes that you can make at it that essentially say, geez, this is a really weird-looking image file.
Is there steganography for music, for MP3s?
Sure, absolutely.
And same issue?
Yeah.
Yes.
The problem is that people look at pieces of the file and say, well, this looks a bit random to me. And then they replace that it looks a bit random to me with something that is encrypted, so it's extremely random. And then you can look at the sort of random and the extremely random and say, wow, these are really different. So even if you put it in a picture, if you put it in a music file, wherever you put it, you're switching the distribution of ones and zeros in a way that people can notice.
So what you're saying is that for known activists, then the tools aren't worthwhile. But if you're an unknown activist, they can still be worthwhile.
That depends on how the surveillance works. If you're watching the traffic, then you can take a look at the pictures you see and see if they look funny. If you're not looking at the traffic and you don't know to look at the person, then you've seen nothing.
If we're dealing with a theoretical situation of a theoretical dissident in Burma, and the question is, okay, you've got good data that we need you to get out of Burma. One option is to switch that person over to Tor and then have them use a nice secure webmail via Tor. But in doing that, you're putting up this giant red flag, essentially saying this person has just become a Tor user. Despite Roger's attempts to the contrary, Tor in much of the world means this person is up to no good. And you see that, and then you immediately start surveilling that person, and then maybe you install a keylogger, or maybe you try a distant camera to look for keystrokes or something like that. So if you're trying to stay undercover, maybe at that point you decide to go with Stego, because no one's paying attention to you anywhere.
And then I just put my Flickr photos.
The pattern of someone posting their Flickr photos, as opposed to the pattern of someone suddenly switching to use Tor, might well be a better path at that point. Mm. The truth is, in cases like that, generally speaking, what we've done is either hand that person a satellite phone, which obviates this whole system and basically allows us to trust a network that is sort of outside of the Burmese government's ability to monitor, or we put something on a memory card, we hand it to the next guy who's going over into Thailand, and then we have him upload it that way. So the truth on these things, for the most part, is that a lot of these measures and countermeasures are pretty theoretical, and the sort of practical stuff that gets done tends to be a lot more practical.
So it seems that there's always been a lot of discussion about sort of multiplexing together technologies that carry potentially sensitive information with technologies that simply can't be blocked, such as HTTPS for online commerce. It would be interesting to see if an effort to improve online commerce in some of these places, for example, might actually make the use of encryption technologies more acceptable, and by that, the need for steganography techniques less important.
When I first went to Armenia, I discovered that I couldn't access any HTTPS website. And the reason for this was 2001. And the law in the book at that point was the only encryption you were allowed to use was a hardware-based encryption developed by the KGB. So if you wished to use computer encryption, you had to go purchase your board from the Armenian successor to the KGB, because it was essentially an escrow key system that they had a backdoor to. Now, obviously, people broke this all the time. They found ways to proxy their way around it. At this point, it's very, very hard to find a place in the world where you can't use HTTPS. Almost all of the good filtering circumvention tools tunnel through HTTPS so that you get that layer of obfuscation on top of it. And it's certainly one of the first things that we tell people to do. I would similarly argue that well-encrypted VPNs are a similar sort of thing. Any country that hopes to do business on an international scale would be ill-advised to block common VPN behavior, because anyone who works in a reasonably secure computing environment is probably using some sort of VPN, whether they're building it themselves over port 25 or whether they're using one pre-implemented in Mac or in Windows. These become channels that you can work through. Again, as I sort of said before on this, I think it's the psychology. I think the psychology is two or three orders of magnitude more important than what the tools can do. And I think the reason this project is important, that doesn't mean this project is not important. I actually think it makes this project more important. I think the better documentation there is about what's actually possible, that's how you combat the psychology.
What's the responsible public face of the project then? I mean, I hear two things on both extremes, one being that if you're an activist, you're screwed because there are so many different ways to get at you that it's going to be hard to evade. And on the other hand, that the level of surveillance is so oversold that we're not getting the level of honest, candid talk that we should be getting, and that's being inappropriately squashed. Is there a way to get those two messages right? And how do we get them out simultaneously without stepping on our tongue in the process?
One of the approaches is to distinguish between are we looking at the whole traffic in the entire country to find out who we should care about versus we have a list of 73 people and we care about them a lot. And I mean, if you're an advocacy person and nobody realizes that they should care about you, they're much less likely to notice you and learn what you're talking about. than if you're already on the list and they're already focusing on you.
Let me make my question actually even a little more pointed, in that there's this class of people that are in this funny overlap between these two populations, who are the people who don't know they're under heavy surveillance, should not be under heavy surveillance, are under heavy surveillance anyway, and are going to get caught up because they're not more careful. They're not, their degree of carefulness is not at the level of the extreme actors as they should be, and they get screwed by it. Is there anything to do for those people?
It's incredibly hard, Rob. I mean, every time I write about this stuff, I kind of sit there and agonize over it. Because when you sit down and you write a guide to, you know, anonymous blogging, the hope is that you're helping the whistleblower who would otherwise never be brave enough to step up. The two things you worry about are that you're also helping the terrorist site that otherwise would get caught. But then the thing that you're really worried about is that you have somehow got it wrong, or even if you got it all right, you didn't do a good enough job of portraying the complexity of the situation to the author, and she or he gets screwed either because of surveillance between user and screen or through one of the known holes within the systems that we use. So the question sort of then becomes, okay, so do you not do it then? And my feeling thus far, based by the fact that I've written some guides on this, and Roger's factoid, based on the fact that he's written some damn useful tools, is no, you put it out there, and you try to be as honest as you possibly can about it. I think the real problem is that it's very, very difficult for people to make good risk decisions in this case. I think getting people to judge the risks of their behavior in this space is a space where absolutely no work has been done. It leads me to think that it would be really fun to, you know, try an experiment at Berkman someday where we know that Chris is watching us. And, you know, two of us randomly selected out of the fellows are attempting to send a message via covert channel. And, you know, Chris has the resources of the center at his disposal. He can tap the Ethernet, he can, you know, tap any of the networks, and the only rules for the two correspondents are that they have to pass back and forth a certain number of messages and they have to be transmitted digitally. Who wins? And there's partial victory there, right? I mean, Chris wins partway if he detects who we are. Chris wins fully if he detects and then decrypts. You know, try it in best of three tests. Does he even get close? My guess is if we had our shit together and we actually did some work ahead of time, he doesn't even get close. My guess is even prepped for it, he misses. And I think you put out a study like that, you know, essentially saying this was just an amateur experiment, but it does reveal this question of how much better do you think the NSA is better than a really smart expert at Harvard? Do you think they're 10x? Do you think they're 100x? Do you think they're 1,000x? I think they're about 5x, based on the guys there that I've talked to. I don't think they're 100x. And so I would love to see studies sort of done on this, just trying to get people to recalibrate their risk. Because when you talk to, and I use this term affectionately for my friends, the tin hats out there, you know, the guys putting aluminum foil in their beanies, they are convinced that they are working against an adversary who has all the computing resources in the universe and half a dozen technologies you've never heard of. And I'm pretty firmly convinced that that's not the case.
Is rationality going to talk the tin hats out of that?
I don't know. But I guess what I'm saying is that rationality might work for the average citizen of Zimbabwe. And right now, the only dialogue out there is tin hat dialogue. I mean, my story in Zimbabwe, that just breaks my heart on this one, right? I mean, so Uncle Bob decided he needed better surveillance laws and got a law passed that, you know, as Chris was saying, with the signature of a minister allows any form of communication, including a paper note, a sealed piece of postal mail, a package, to be monitored. Okay? Zim, at the same time, can't feed its people. It doesn't have the money to be monitoring the internet. And ONI experiments have shown no filtering on the internet, even of my illegal blacklisted site, talking about the horrible things in Zimbabwe, isn't blocked over there. But because it got coverage in the Zimbabwe Herald, lots of Zimbabweans have been emailing the heads of ISPs and saying things like, please take me off of the Zimbabwe political humor list. I don't want Bob to see that I'm receiving jokes about him. So that's sort of the level of paranoia that comes into play. I think the only way you can possibly combat this is by trying to put some facts on the ground about what can happen. Because otherwise, when you know about the possibility of surveillance, you see a Chinese telecom engineer in Harare, you know that a law has been passed, and then the assumption, understandable, is that you plug it all together and that every piece of telco is being monitored. Whereas I generally think, Morgan Tsvangirai's cell phone is probably being monitored. I think the MDC offices are bugged, and I think beyond that, you're probably pretty safe in some ways. But I don't know how
Unless you talk to your neighbors about how you feel about Mugabe, in which case...
Right.
In which case, humans flips on you. They may talk to the secret police, and there you go. And it's a much more dangerous thing than any of the digital networks.
Here's a tin hat theory. It's not mine.
Yep.
I was at a friend of mine. Close personal friend, a cousin, heard this. I was at a small telecommunications conference, which some of you know about, and I guess I'll leave nameless. It's like 50 people. And it included a bunch of senior people, not from the telcos. This was sort of the rebel telco group. Their conversation a couple years ago was, we assume that even though we are off in a relatively remote part of Massachusetts, other end of from Etham, that we are being surveyed through parabolic whatever they're using. And I said, really? Why would they even, A, why would they care? And B, how would they know? They watch the flight plans. They know who's traveling where. They see this group coming together. So, yeah, of course they're going to be surveying them. This was an extremely rational, extremely well-educated set of senior technologists. Comments? How big is the tin hat? I thought it was a little self-aggrandizing, actually.
Having been to the gathering you're referring to, I can't really imagine it being particularly interesting to the intelligence community.
We're going to bring the man down.
Frankly, people there tend to think they're much more intelligent than they actually are, I would argue. But
does it come down to budgets? I mean, you were talking about Zimbabwe can't feed its people. Whenever I talk to FBI officers, they complain that they solve 2% of their cases and nobody's giving them any money to do anything. Is there some secret organization out there with $20 billion and they can do everything?
There are 13,000 FBI field agents. 6,000 of them have desktop computers. 7,000 FBI agents do not have desktop computers.
They don't have computers. Underestimate
how badly supplied law enforcement is. It's crazy. I would love to find some way to sort of work on this subject because we just impute so much more capability to these people than we should.
But that goes back to my question about what private industry is doing. Because private industry actually has the money to gather the data and could do it for their own purposes or, you know, if the law has changed, could be compelled to do it and save the government the work. So I learned an astonishing thing from one of my co-authors who's a software consultant, and he works for a major financial services company whose name is in the newspaper every day, an enormous financial services company. And so he was there, and he wanted to read his email, and he tried to get to Gmail and couldn't. They blocked Gmail inside this company because they want to monitor everything. Mm-hmm. So they've got, whatever it is, they've got it. Every office of this enormous multinational financial services company. And so that data source is,
let's unpack that and talk about what's really capable there.
All right.
The reason they're doing it is because as a major financial services company, the thing that they are terrified about is insider trading.
Right.
So what they are really worried about is that someone is going to send an email out from within that company either saying, hey, big deal is going down, buy Northwest stock, or is going to send it to Andrew Ross Sorkin over at the New York Times so he gets a scoop on the story and probably scotch the deal ahead of time.
Right.
So what they're doing is they are firewalling to some level of effectiveness public webmail servers because they wouldn't be able to monitor the transmission. because if you're going in through HTTPS into Gmail and sending it out, unless you have Google's cooperation, they wouldn't be able to get the message. Right? Mm. They are not hand-reading every message coming through that. They probably have an updated list based on every company they're doing a deal for, and if that comes through the filter and they see that company name being mentioned, then perhaps it gets manually reviewed before it gets sent out. So,
Maybe even less than that. They may just want to be able to tell the feds that they're doing it. You know,
that's absolutely right.
They have no interest in looking at any of it.
But I think the question in all of this is, when you build something like that, the assumption that comes into play is, oh, the company's reading all of my email. And the question that then comes into play is that a reasonable assumption, and how do you calibrate your risk tolerance within?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would have assumed that people would think not that it was all being read actively, but that it could be read 5 years from now when they wanted to back up mm-hmm. and see how that
seems more. I'm also kind of reassured by that, Harriet.
Good.
Something that Chris would go on at length about is that when you move,
I mean, they're
the
not
government...
locking. You know, they haven't put a Faraday cage around so people can't use their Blackberries. You know, right. It's not like the bits can't get out of the building, I don't think.
But when you go to the private use of data, the thing we're probably most acutely worried about is that data leaks across the firewalls that are supposed to exist between appropriate uses. And if those firewalls are working properly, then maybe we have a chance of actually keeping that data where it's supposed to be. And it's when those firewalls break down, which I think is pretty easy, is when the data's in large chunks starts to leak across boundaries, and then we start cross-hashing things, and I start to get nervous at that point. So those people work in the financial services, and they have my data. I'm glad they're shut down.
Well, but I mean, you know, if human beings could be bifurcated into their professional and personal roles, that line of reasoning might work. But you know, anyway, that's.
It's not perfect. I think the more safeguards that are there, and the more incentives, and the more threats that are there, the better chance we have of those walls holding. Or you see no chance of them holding.
I would not want the only people working at this, you know, at these companies, to be people who were happy with the fact that they couldn't send a personal message between 9 and 5.
Can I just check to see if I'm understanding some what's been transpiring here correctly? What I'm hearing is that from a policy, legal, technical, social, many different dimensions, there's really, as far as surveillance is concerned, there's not much difference between activists and terrorists, anti-terrorism, and repression. That effectively, actually, if you really look at it, it's basically the same thing. There are efforts to undermine a given regime, mm-hmm. regardless of what the moral or whatever intent is. That our efforts to basically any technical capability to stop one would also stop the other. That's one. And two, if the bigger problem is really a disparity of cultural perception of the ability to surveil versus the actual ability to surveil, the problem is that on the one hand, you might be thwarting idiot terrorists who are kind of interested in blowing things up and not really, or you know, not going to take all the steps necessary to. But you're also going to be thwarting many, many, many activists who are just going to stop talking because they're scared, and at the same time, because the reality of the surveillance is so minimal that we have a false sense of security that comes out. I mean, what is that? Is that kind of the what I should be taking away from this session?
There are a couple of things. First of all, yes, from the perspective of surveillance technology, at least, a terrorist and an activist are indistinguishable. They're both people who are trying to hide their communication from someone.
So how come we can catch activists but not terrorists?
We don't know that we're not catching.
Right. We may be sending them to get them.
Because 9/11 hasn't happened again.
And
Colin would say.
We haven't caught anybody. We're willing to try an actual.
Right.
Well, if we caught some big terrorists, wouldn't the government want to tell us that we did? Yeah. Even if they don't want to tell us how they caught them.
Right.
You'll hear about it in October shortly before the inauguration.
So I'll channel Colin for a moment, and I may be getting him wrong, in which case I apologize. But I, once in a conversation like this recently, he said that I have good reason to believe that. Bad guys are caught, that activities are that we don't want to happen are stopped, and it's not publicized because they fall somewhere in your, it's not even the matrix, your multiple-dimensional, multi-vector set of considerations about when we want to be transparent. And apparently we don't want to be transparent about this, possibly because it would compromise the channel.
Right. So what happens is there's a perceived threat of compromising the effectiveness of catching terrorists, but if you... don't, I mean, that was the argument that I probably failed to make, but tried to make, is that if you don't break that down into what actually affects catching terrorists and what is actually something that should be talked about so that you're not catching other people in the same net. So you don't have the, you know, your Quran scholar who can't actually do something positive because the surveillance regime is locked down to a system where we can't talk about this, we can't modify this, we are capturing everyone, we are automatically putting you on no-fly lists, in a way that's basically, you know, countering what the goal of the program is, at least in this instance, which is to prevent terrorism. You know, and if you don't have any transparency around the system, then then there's no way to distinguish between terrorists and activists.
But if what I was saying is that if there is no way to distinguish between them, from a policy, legal, technical, all those other aspects, there's no difference between a terrorist and an activist, then do they have any choice? But I mean, seeing any options.
I don't see how there's not a legal distinction between a terrorist and an activist. I mean, if you're, obviously that depends on the legal regime you're in. You know, if you're in, a repressive country, then maybe any activist is a terrorist. But that's a policy decision.
I think Jane has a point that it's a difference between a behavioral analysis and a content analysis, right? The reason that Shahid can't post on these fora is because we can't read Arabic in the U.S. intelligence community. We have so few Arabic translators that his behavior, which would be obviously beneficial and the sort of thing that someone should be giving him, a Congressional Medal of Honor for, is simply going to get him slapped on a no-fly list because we make a judgment based on a behavior pattern rather than a content in it. If we were capable of doing the sort of content analysis that most people believe we're capable of doing, he'd be in the clear. But we're not. and so when you just look at pure behavioral patterns, I'm with your assertion entirely. I think the reason I get invited to talk to the intelligence community is precisely because they see absolutely no distinction between activists and terrorists. They basically assume that they use exactly the same tools, exactly the same techniques, and all that's really different is the purposes. And in many of the countries where I work, whether you call them an activist or whether you call them a terrorist has to do with whether you're on the side of that government or not. And certainly the people that I work with in Zim, certainly the people that I work with in Egypt, would be characterized as enemies of the state of both of those countries.
I think we should probably continue the conversation as we go along, but please join me in thanking Chris for an excellent time.
I have a question for you. If